Media Minutes. Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Communities large and small all around the country are hopping on the public broadband bandwagon. They're looking to set up community-wide fiber optic networks or wireless clouds of connectivity to provide both residents and visitors with broadband access for free or at low cost. Some are looking at broadband like any other utility, similar to water or electric service, and are offering connectivity under similar models. To incumbent phone and cable companies, however, this is perceived as a huge threat to their subscriber base. The reason? Community internet services that are run like public utilities have been proven to offer better broadband access at lower rates than private providers. This is why companies have been lobbying state legislatures so hard over the last year. They seek state-by-state laws to prohibit broadband competition from the public sector. So far, more than a dozen states have banned or significantly restricted the ability of cities and towns to offer such connectivity. One of those states is Wisconsin, where a grassroots group tried to find a way around a state ban on the public provision of broadband. Norman Stockwell with Madison Community Wireless Advocates says the city began exploring a community internet plan earlier this year. Just recently, it announced it would farm out the building of a wireless network to a private company who would then install its equipment on the city's power poles.
It won't cost the city of Madison anything, and it's not an exclusive agreement, which means other wireless providers could also come into the picture.
This is a far cry from the ubiquitous public access the group had in mind, but the public-private partnership seems to be the model many communities are subscribing to as they consider building their own broadband networks. Houston is the latest major city to announce such a partnership and hopes to have at least a part of its network online next year. Most expect public access to these networks to cost less than a comparable cable or DSL connection. As for Madison, Stockwell says they'd still like to try and establish a non-profit wireless presence that could offer free broadband for the city.
Our intention is to continue exploring different options and probably begin to work on a neighborhood level since the CellNet agreement is not exclusive. It means that other people could come into play and could provide service, and maybe things could work out in such a way that everyone will be able to work together.
Next door in Iowa, citizens in 32 cities and towns voted on referenda this month calling for the creation of broadband utilities. More than half decided to go for it, despite $1.5 million dumped into the campaigns by incumbent cable and phone providers Mediacom and Quest to try and rally no votes. Just when it seemed this issue would remain local, though, Congress signals it may get involved. Three bills dealing with community internet are currently in circulation on Capitol Hill. Two would forbid or restrict cities and towns from operating a publicly accessible broadband network, while the third would supersede local and state restrictions to allow unfettered competition between the public and private sectors.
Digitize your old records and cassette tapes while you still can. The recording and motion picture industries are teaming up to lobby Congress on legislation that would plug the so-called analog hole. This term was coined 3 years ago by the Motion Picture Association of America. It refers to the ability to convert content from digital to analog and vice versa, like videotaping a movie or making an MP3 of something recorded off the radio. Converting digital content to analog strips it of any built-in content protection systems, which allow it to be recopied at will. Movie studios and record labels would like Congress to require electronics manufacturers to embed special chips in all recording devices that would automatically shut them down if someone attempts to convert copyrighted content from analog to digital. This would make it impossible to transfer records and tapes you rightfully own to MP3 or other digital formats. A discussion draft of such legislation began circulating on Capitol Hill earlier this month.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. Primetime television content is shrinking to make way for more advertising. In any given hour, an average program contains 42 minutes of content and 18 minutes of ads. But if you combine the spot load with show promos, teasers, and recap clips, the actual new content of any given week's program is closer to 40 minutes, meaning that for every 2 minutes of new content aired every week, there's a minute of filler. TV networks are adding more filler by adding more commercial breaks. The industry standard for an hour-long primetime show a year ago was 4 breaks per hour, but now it's 6. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a very special show for you, recorded a few days before going on air so that I could be out scouting new shows for you this weekend on the road. And what we're doing is we're talking about the future of the Internet, the future of the global communication system, and a number of very important developments that are taking place in the news about how the Internet will be structured and the global communication system will be structured in the coming years. And as our guest today, we're very fortunate to have, in my opinion, the premier expert on telecommunications and information systems in the world. And it just so happened that he happens to be a faculty member here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a colleague of mine, Dan Schiller, professor, also in the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences, as well as the Institute for Communications Research. Dan Schiller, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob.
Dan, the big news, of course, that people in the activist world and people involved in global communication politics have been dealing with over the past 2 weeks has been the World Summit in the Information Society, which is just wrapped up in Tunis, that's taken place over the last couple of weeks. It's gotten a lot of attention, but it hasn't really broken into the mainstream what's been going on there, although it's something that I think will command the interest of everyone who listens to this program. What is the World Summit for the Information Society, and what was it set up to do, and what happened?
Well, it's a lot of different things all at once, of course, but the World Summit on the Information Society was set up about 3 or 4 years ago in the context of an organization most people have never heard of called the International Telecommunications Union. And this is an international organization. It's part of the UN system, part of the United Nations system. So that was the organizational framework within which this set of meetings was to be held. There have been two meetings. The first of them was in Geneva in the fall of 2003. That's 2 years ago. And the most recent one, the second one, in Tunis, in Tunisia, just concluded a couple, end of November or mid-November. These meetings had two different themes. The first one was dedicated to the discussion of the digital divide on an international scale, and many, many questions having to do with what the digital divide looked like, how severe it was, what were the implications of it, what was being done about it, what could be done to remedy it, formed the theme of the first important meeting in Geneva. The second meeting, which has just been concluded, November 19th, I believe, was the day it ended, had a very different, although related theme, and that was Internet governance. Now, for most people, the idea of Internet governance is a bit of who knows what that means, Internet governance. Mm-hmm. We're taught to think that the Internet has no governance. It's just a kind of a ramshackle structure of all kinds of high-tech equipment and software that's put together or plugged together somehow, and it works.
Magically works.
Yeah, we get Google, or we get Amazon, or we get eBay, or whatever we get, and it somehow all comes off. But in fact, like all communication systems, there is a structure of control. It doesn't determine every last thing. It doesn't mean that you can't have a whole range of different uses of the internet as a vast network of networks. But it does govern some of the basic principles of that structure of the internet. And it does set certain limits and open up the possibilities for certain forms of political and economic intervention in the future. Mm-hmm. And as the internet has become more and more pervasive across dozens of nations, although there are, to be sure, still very significant disparities in this area, but as it's become more pervasive so that today there's a billion users of the internet, and I think I just saw that the average day sees 27 billion page views on the internet around the world. As the internet has become more general, more pervasive, questions of its control, of its governance, of its structure have almost inescapably become more important to more people.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We recorded this show a few days before going on air because I was going to be out of town over Thanksgiving weekend. Please don't call in. Sit back and relax. We're talking about the future of the internet, the governance of the internet, and a major meeting that just took place in Tunisia earlier in the month of November about who would control the internet. And that's what we're talking about now. And Dan Schiller, our guest today, is the author of numerous books, including the recent book, already I think a classic, called Digital Capitalism, and has a brand new book coming out with the University of Illinois Press, the fall of 2006 that I'm looking forward to, called How to Think About Information. Dan, let's follow up on what you're about to say.
Yeah, in order to really do justice to your question about how important this meeting has been, the most recent tally, there were 23,000 attendees of the World Summit on the Information Society meeting in Tunis.
23,000?
23,000 attendees, including dozens of heads of state, maybe 1,000 journalists, many representatives of non-governmental organizations, maybe 60 or 100 CEOs of major corporations. And yet, with all of that prominence, it has not been given page one attention in the United States.
No, I mean, it's been treated as of less importance than whether the Yankees get a middle-inning relief pitcher.
Which is itself a very telling sign about how our priorities in the media system are organized.
So just to follow up on this point before we get back to WISIS and what it was doing, were we in a country like, say, Egypt or Czech Republic or Japan or someplace like that, there's a greater likelihood that this would be covered as a pretty serious story.
Absolutely. This is a major story. It's a story that has to do with the shaping of the world that we are going to be living in, insofar as that world is increasingly interwoven with electronics.
So we have the internet governance question. Who's going to govern it? Who's going to make the rules? How's it going to develop? On one hand, the core issues of the World Summit on the Information Society. And then we have the internet's history and its actual current development. It's primarily a U.S.-based phenomenon. I mean, it's a global institution, but it's originated in the United States. Is there a conflict there?
Well, you've put your finger on the very nature of the conflict. The fact is that the internet was created not just in the United States. To say that it's created in the United States makes it seem as if it's something that all U.S. citizens have an equal stake in. Mm-hmm. In fact, the internet was created within the most secretive workings of the military-industrial complex, and it remained in that way for the first 20 years of its history.
Now, what years were those 20 years?
It was originated, people quarrel over the exact dating as, is often the case amongst academics. But usually the dating begins in 1969 to 1973. And from that point forward, as the technology began to be developed for the next 20 years, pretty much, the internet, or what we would today call the internet, although it wasn't even called the internet until the mid-1980s, was a very, very exclusive enclave of military strategists, computer scientists at elite universities, and a few other government agencies around the United States and increasingly around a few corresponding nations in the rest of the world.
Now, this is an interesting point. You talk about the crucial role of military funding and military research and development to getting the internet going. There's a recent book, and I forget the title. I'm sure you'll note when I refer to it right now, that argues that the development of the internet was due less to that and more to the fact that on these elite university campuses, the sort of the hacker crowd, the geeks who were doing this high-tech internet development were like out of the 60s. They were hippies. They believed in open source. They shared stuff. They weren't proprietary. And it was really, more as much or more the sort of open culture of the university and sort of this hippie ethos that really got the internet going in a way that never would have happened in a purely corporate environment or in a purely military environment. This is really the missing piece. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I mean, excuse me, I think it's true up to a point in the sense that you have a group of people who are willing to try anything, who are staying up late at night drinking, coffee or Coke after Coke, and they're fiddling around with the technology. They've got an increasing sense of elation and excitement at what they're trying to unlock here. There's a sense that they can share it with one another. They're all out of MIT anyway and Stanford and USC, and so they all know each other. It's a very, very small enclave of people. But the institutional structure in which they are working, regardless of whatever their own whims or personal tendencies may have been in terms of the counterculture, their own institutional structure is one of top-down garrison state. It's the secretive workings of the military and of a few major contracting organizations that set the parameters for the use of the system. And everything that they did that may have involved hacking or may have involved, you know, the free sharing of resources was occurring within an utterly proprietary context. There was no way outsiders got into this system.
Okay, we're talking to Dan Schiller about the internet, about governance of the internet, and the international meeting in Tunisia, the World Summit, the Information Society, was just concluded earlier this month in November, dealing with who will govern the internet, how will it be governed around the world in the coming generation as the internet increasingly becomes the central nervous system of much of human existence, social existence in our times. Now, just before we get back to WSIS, let's just follow through this story. The military plays a crucial role in the development of the internet in the 70s and the 80s. Then starting in the late 80s, the internet begins to sort of catch on a bit and absolutely explodes by the early 90s with the development of the World Wide Web. How does this change the regulation and funding of the internet and the nature of it?
Yeah. You see, what happened was, just to put a very quick gloss on it, as the—
Take your time. We got some time here, Dan.
As the internet's potentialities, and this was a much cruder internet, a much more specialized internet, a much more, if you will, geeky internet than the one that we currently possess. You had to have specialized competence to make use of it. But as the potentialities began to be understood and developed by this small community of insiders at computer science departments, computer scientists at other universities who were not part of the system wanted in, and they wanted in order to be able to share files. They wanted in to be able to work together in this shared way within their own areas of specialized interest. So pressure began to develop to open the internet up, and eventually this was done through a transfer of a part of the system from the military to the National Science Foundation, which we still, a U.S. Entity. It's part of the U.S. government to fund a wider access to the internet system, still only among computer science departments. And then
what year was this about?
And this would have been in the 1980s. Okay. Into the late 80s and early 90s, and to seed some of the networking facilities that were needed to share such computer resources. But while this was occurring, and this gets to the core of your question, the governance arrangements were also beginning to become, one could say, a little more formalized. And the governance arrangements that began to be crafted, and here we're talking really into the 1990s and the Clinton administration, there began to be different structures created to take care of certain functions which had previously been much more informal, much more ad hoc, much more just shoot from the hip kind of things. Mm-hmm. So that because the number of users was growing and the number of functions of the internet and the different kinds of things you could do with it was increasing, there began to be a real authentic need for some form of governance structure. For example, and preeminently, to assign addresses to different computers that would then hook up to the system. You need to have addresses the same way that we need to have telephone numbers for the telephone system. Mm-hmm. You need to have addresses. So where's the master list going to be kept? And mm-hmm. how is it going to be used? Who's going to have access to it? And how is it going to be that when a new subscriber wants to join the system, they can get their code assigned and put on that master list?
And what did they do to solve that problem?
Well, it's a complex story, but the basic arrangements as they were formalized in 1998, in that period, were that 1997, 1998, that the Department of Commerce, which is an executive branch agency, would delegate to a not-for-profit California organization, a not-for-profit corporation called ICANN, and the initials stand for Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, that ICANN would act as a contractor to the U.S. government in supervising these functions. And there are some other organizations that ICANN in turn works with, and there's been plenty of fighting between these organizations for dominance, you might say. But the ICANN element, or the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, became the key focus for much of the internet governance process, in particular having to do with that part of it that is called the domain name system. Mm-hmm. And maybe it would be helpful to just spell out a little bit again what that means.
Sure.
The domain name system means that you don't have, when you go onto the internet, to remember a multi-digit number. It might be 15, 20 digits long, to connect to the particular information resource, meaning the particular computer, that you're trying to get to when you go onto the system. So instead of trying to, you know, key in 20 numbers to get to Amazon.com, you remember Amazon and you key that in and it gets you there very easily. Well, that correspondence between a name and a particular numerical address is one of the key functions that ICANN either performs or delegates to other organizations. Mm-hmm. And then there is another one, which is the .edu or .com or .org element. That is what's called a top-level domain. And the way in which computers on the internet interconnect with one another is to start from the right-hand side of that internet address, not the left-hand side, not the Amazon dot, mm-hmm. but the com side. And starting with the com or the EDU, they go to a specialized computer, a specialized root server, it's called, that gets that information and begins the process of connecting them to the ultimate destination that they're looking for, in this example, Amazon.
And currently these functions have been set up to be run by ICANN and people they designate to work with them.
Exactly. So the
problem, no matter wherever in the world. So
no matter where in the world they are. So unlike the world's telephone systems, which are organized by national authorities, the internet is in effect what some lawyers call a universal jurisdiction. Amazon goes all over the world. Google goes all over the world. Microsoft goes all over the world. But the domain name system that allows that and that cultivates it is run by a nonprofit corporation in California, which is beholden to the Department of Commerce of the United States.
And what's the problem with that? I can understand in the case of telegraph or telephone that you don't want someone in London controlling the Japanese or Tanzanian phone system. You want to control your own phone system. But, you know, does that present any problems for the people of Russia or China or Uruguay that the United States basically runs the global digital communication system?
Let's say that The answer, in a word, is yes, it does present a problem. But, of course, we need to explain a little more about what the problem is. The problem is that people around the rest of the world are fearful that the United States will use this special control that it continues to exert over Internet governance. It calls it free. It calls it open governance, but it is real control, that the U.S. will use that control in order to create specialized advantages for its own companies and its own executive branch agencies. And there is reason to believe that this concern has legitimacy.
Yeah, can you give an example of how that might play out? Because it sounds fairly abstract at that level.
Well, in 1980... before the internet was any kind of a significant public resource or network, the United States presidency under Carter in the outgoing months of the Carter administration made it known that it was likely or at least considering withholding access to the system of international communications that then existed around the international satellite consortium called Intelsat to Iran. In other words, they said, we're going to quarantine Iran because of the hostage crisis and what came after. We're going to cut off Iran from international communications.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the world knows this. The rest of the world remembers this. And the rest of the world is concerned that something very similar to that could happen with regard to the internet.
Can a country be cut out?
Yes.
It can be. I thought the internet was supposed to have these magical powers that, you know, no government could stop it.
From the point of view of subscribing individuals and perhaps from the point of view of hackers with very, very extensive specialized technical competence, that well, from the point of view of the hackers, that may be true. From the point of view of ordinary individuals, it is not true.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way that we are in a position to do an end run around the kinds of control that can be exercised about the internet by a central authority such as ICANN and the Department of Commerce, where there is a mind to exercise that power. And there have been two recent factors that have entered directly into this discussion, and that probably would be appropriate to mention at this point.
Sure, go ahead.
The policy under the Carter administration had been to say that ICANN, the contractor to the U.S. Department of Commerce that controls the domain name system, would be made fully independent, would lose its connection to the Department of Commerce, that it would be fully privatized was the term they used, in the imminently from now. The period of the current contract goes till, I think, September 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so the early theory had been and the policy had been that ICANN would be cut free and be a completely separate independent entity. The Bush administration said early this last summer in June, I think, of 2005, that they were backing away from that and that they were not under any circumstances going to lose control of ICANN.
Mm-hmm.
The international community took that in the context of the other things that the Bush administration is doing internationally as a sign of unilateralism that boded poorly for any kind of truly international governance structure over the internet. And then a second thing happened late in the summer that added to their fears. It's a curious and even paradoxical thing that occurred because it's something that many of us might feel has its own justice in a way. But there was a proposal to create a porno zone on the internet, a .xxx generic top level domain.
Mm-hmm.
And in the face of the conservative pressure from within some of the ranks of the Bush administration itself, and even more broadly, the Department of Commerce did intervene explicitly for the first time in anyone's overt knowledge of this particular history. The Department of Commerce told ICANN, you may not authorize the creation of a .xxx zone or domain. When this occurred, the rest of the world, again, many of the countries were fully in agreement with the substance of this decision. A lot of countries in the world are much more conservative than the United States on some of these cultural issues. But the result was to say that, well, it happened once. the executive branch of the United States intervened explicitly and directly to produce a policy outcome that it wanted without any consultative process with the rest of the world, coming on top of the fact that the Bush administration had already said they're not going to privatize ICANN. This looked very much to much of the world like a recipe for U.S. domination going forward in a period where the internet is going to be ever more important.
You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Before we get back to our guest, Dan Schiller, I want to say a brief word, if I can. Just last week, Richard Merritt, Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois, passed away. He was a colleague of mine and of Dan Schiller's, and he was a big supporter of this show from the very beginning. At every pledge drive, he was always there, and we're going to miss Dick a lot, and our thoughts go out to his family. Our guest today on Media Matters is Dan Schiller. Dan is my colleague at the University of Illinois, one of the world's premier experts on information and telecommunications policy and history, author of numerous books, including Digital Capitalism, and the forthcoming book from University of Illinois Press, and we'll have you on when it comes out, Dan, How to Think About Information. We're talking about what I think in some ways might seem like an obtuse or abstract issue, sort of the internet governance and its history. But I think everyone now who lives so much of their lives online, so much of their activities online, understand that what we're dealing with here are really fundamental issues about the course of political and social life in the coming generation and the current generation. We've been talking about the emergence of the U.S. domination of the political domination of the governance of the internet, combined with the internet becoming a truly global phenomenon worldwide. And before we talk about WISIS, which is where we will be getting to in a second, the World Summit and the Information Society, the logical thing is, I hear you explain what you're just talking about, Dan, is why don't the countries in the rest of the world just start their own internet? You know, and just sort of say, you know, we'll set up our own and everyone's going to switch over and we aren't going to let the U.S. government sort of, the U.S. isn't investing that much money. It isn't a money issue, is it?
Well, of course, you know, if you're talking about some of the smaller and poorer countries of the world, there is always.
Well, say the United Nations set up its own internet.
But the United Nations might, I suppose, in a world that looks somewhat different from ours, go in that direction. But the more realistic alternative that many people fear is that there will be precisely the kind of balkanization of what has up to now been a relatively cohesive system that you just alluded to. That, in other words, different countries will set up their own internet systems.
And they won't be interconnected.
Well, they probably will be interconnected, but the terms on which they would be interconnected would be open to the deliberation and negotiation of the different national authorities. Mm-hmm. And this is something that it could happen, and there are threats being made by particularly aggrieved countries. China has made some moves in this sort of a direction to move that way. But there are great advantages to be derived for not only big businesses, but also ordinary people and NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are trying to mobilize around all sorts of issues, with having a global internet, a single system where if you point to a particular address, you can get to the same place as somebody
everyone in the
from
world
around
can
the
get
world.
To, yeah, if you and put there, on a website, everyone can get it.
And it's a very, very significant advance that this can be accomplished.
Yeah.
The question is, who will capture the benefit of that advance? And this is a contradictory question.
So let's go back to WISIS now, if we can. We've done the background. What was the range of debate or discussion at WISIS at the World Summit Information Society? These 23,000 people assemble. The topic, internet governance. You've set the stage. What happened?
There was a significant demand voiced by many different nations for what's called the internationalization of internet governance. The fact of what this would look like, exactly what form it might take, what organizational structure might be created, how ICANN would have to change, all of these issues were simply left there for subsequent discussion. But that there should be some positive commitment to the internationalization of control over what is, after all, an international system was the basic starting point of dozens of countries criticizing U.S. dominance of the system.
So there was more or less general agreement on that I couldn't imagine the United States government, knowing what you've just said about them, would be too excited about that prospect.
The U.S. sees the WSIS process. They were very concerned about it going into it because they thought, particularly because suddenly the European Union bolted from its previous pro-U.S. position, and the European Union, with its 25 members, went behind a version or supported a version of internationalization of internet governance. When this occurred, it meant that the United States was pretty much all alone in the WSIS deliberations over this all-important issue of internet governance. And they were justly very nervous about it, although also very, very arrogant and bombastic about what they were hoping to accomplish and why that would be the best of all possible outcomes. What is significant is that the United States is boasting, after the WSIS meetings have concluded, that it won exactly what it wanted to win, which is continued paramountcy, continued control by the ICANN organization. No internationalization.
I mean, but it sounds like this wasn't the last meeting along these lines. Where does the WSIS go from here on out? It didn't conclude anything, it sounds like.
Well, it didn't conclude anything, but this is one of the areas in which the very first point we got to comes back to be significant. The fact that the United States news media pays so little attention to this issue now means that we are ill-prepared as a people to understand what comes next. Mm-hmm. And what will come next is a continuing process of political negotiation, because despite the U.S. leadership protestations about this, and despite the fact that they claim victory and that ICANN will continue as a California corporation dependent on the Department of Commerce, the rest of the world believes that the outcome of the WSIS has been to create a structure for the internationalization of internet governance. Something called the Internet Governance Forum has been newly authorized as an outcome of this process, mm-hmm. and it's beginning its first meetings in the spring of 2006. So it's coming in the imminent future.
So there actually has been sort of a formal development from this WSIS meeting then?
Absolutely. And the question is, where does it go? And above all, can there be political pressure brought to bear to develop this process further towards the international comity, the international relations of peacefulness and mutual toleration that one has to hope form the infrastructure for all such deliberations going forward?
You're listening to Dan Schiller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is Thanksgiving Sunday, of course, the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. We recorded this show shortly before Thanksgiving because I'm going to be on the road today. So sit back, relax, listen to the show. Don't call in, though. Let Dan Schiller, my guest, a professor here at the University of Illinois, a noted expert on telecommunication and information policy, talk to us and educate us on what's happening with internet governance globally and what's just happened at the World Summit for the Information Society, the major event with 23,000 people attending about the future of global internet governance that Dan Schiller has been talking about. We've got a lot of ground to cover still, Dan. We don't have a great deal of time left, but I do want to wrap up on this point you just raised, it seems very important to me. This Internet Globalization Forum?
Internet Governance Forum.
Internet Governance Forum, excuse me. So it sounds like for Americans who are hearing nothing about this issue except through this show, basically, and maybe a few obscure websites, if they're interested and think this is an important issue, there's something to be gained by pressuring politicians, trying to make this an issue here, to understand that the American people, to the extent they know about this, are in favor of, you know, a more representative management of the internet, that it be publicly accountable.
You know, without trying to take up too much more time on this, I think that is absolutely essential, and I think it represents only the realization of a more democratic potential within this country as opposed to just in the rest of the world. The reason is, to go back to the early discussion we had, the internet as it currently is constituted is not even accountable to the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone to the rest of the world. If we can democratize internet governance, we ourselves within this country will also be principal beneficiaries of that process.
Dan Schiller, you, more than anyone I know, understand that the current issues that are coming up with the internet globally and with the WSIS, the World Summit for the Information Society, are not new, but they reflect long-term historical issues of information inequality in media and communication and telecommunication systems. And that the WSIS is not the only forum in which these have been played out over time or are being played out today. I want you to talk a little bit, if you would, just put it in the sort of broad historical context so we can appreciate the political dynamics that are at play here, and then specifically talk a little bit about UNESCO historically through to the present, the role that the United Nations Educational, Science, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, has played as a deliberative body dealing with global information and media inequality.
Well, Bob, this is a vast subject.
It's like a prelim question, doesn't it?
It does. It's a vast subject, but again,
I won't grade
it's a subject,
you, don't worry.
It's a subject on which we, in a sense, can do no better than to try to bring what we have in the way of knowledge to try to illuminate, because it's of such critical importance, and yet it's a hidden history in this country. The United States, basically, starting around 100 years ago, began to struggle with Great Britain over control of the international communication system of that time. Britain ruled the waves. That was how the saying went. Britain also ruled the systems that were under the waves, the submarine cables, that were how it administered its global empire. Mm-hmm. When the U.S. rose to global power in the early 20th century, a system of international communications system, a system of international communications that was a U.S. system rather than a British system, was perceived as a primary strategic necessity by American political and corporate leaders. Mm-hmm. And so the history here in its largest outlines is one of successive U.S. leaders' efforts to create and administer the development of such a U.S.-based system of international communications that would support U.S. military and economic objectives around the rest of the world. The first effort to do this occurred around radio technology, simple radio broadcasting and radio telecommunication signals in the first three decades of the 20th century. The second major and really decisive movement in that direction came after World War II and was realized around the International Telecommunications Satellite Consortium in the 1970s, the early 1970s, based on developments in rocketry and telecommunications satellites going back into the 1950s and Sputnik and so forth. That system was organized with the U.S. as its center. The U.S. had 50% of the ownership rights of the Intelsat system in its statutes, so that no decision could be made about the structure of that system and the kinds of uses it would have without U.S. executive branch assent.
Well, let's just back up for a second. But this satellite system you're talking about, this is a global system. These are weather satellites, communication satellites.
These
are
communication satellites that carry everything from telephone calls to television programs to computer data.
And this is a global system that's set up. This Intelsat's a global company? I mean, what is this?
Well, it's different today, but it was set up to be a global consortium of states. The U.S. signatory to the treaty was a private corporation. It's called a chosen instrument. It's called COMSAT, the Communications Satellite Corporation. Mm-hmm. Every other subscribing nation to the Intelsat system did so through a government agency. Mm-hmm. And over time, the changes occurred in the nature of the Intelsat system. But the key point that I'm trying to bring out here is that this international system, which allowed communications and video exchanges and data traffic to Europe and to Latin America and to Asia, all of these places, was run by and for United States interests.
The point I want to get at is that the principle behind this, even before you get to COMSAT and the U.S. domination of it, was that it was in the interest of the human race that there not be 30 different countries firing satellites up, smashing into each other in outer space, but you have a coherent system that's regulated to work for all our benefit. Is that?
That was the initial idea. Of course, Now we have 30 or 40 countries with satellites out in outer space, and there's more space garbage than there is in some parts of the United States, which is saying something.
Mm-hmm. And so the United States, because it was politically the dominant power in the 1950s and 60s, was able to dominate the satellite system that came along. And it I assume in the radio era, the first era of fighting over who gets to dominate the airwaves, The United States was also the dominant power then, but it was not then. It was probably far more contested with Britain and Germany and other countries, I assume.
The United States in the radio era was the aspirant power. It was the ascending global power, and it didn't really definitively unseat Britain in the communications realm and, in some respects, more generally until the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. At that point, it used the then new telecommunications instrumentality of satellite communication to create an international system that would be supportive of the extension of U.S. transnational capital, that would be supportive of the extension of U.S. military bases around much of the rest of the world, and that could be then used as literally a launch pad for administering what today I think some of us would call an empire.
Now, the great change in the political history of the world, one of the great changes in the 1960s that comes on the heels of COMSAT and sort of the domination of these policies by the United States, global governance of communication, is the emergence of the newly independent countries of Africa and Asia, which then go from being non-existent or only a handful of these countries existing to being a numerical majority in the United Nations and a numerical majority in UNESCO and ITU and all these countries. So it sort of changes the calculus and the equation for how international power is diverse when suddenly the sort of propertyless lowlier suddenly have the majority of the votes in these institutions. What did this mean for communications? Especially, I want you to talk, we don't have a great deal of time, but talk a little bit about the immediate predecessor of WSIS in the 1970s, the New World Information and Communication Order.
Well, you've just put your finger on the structural change that was decisive. Basically, there were 100 new nations created through torturous processes of decolonization and, in some cases, real social struggle in the 20, 30 years after World War II. The great promise was that we would realize a truly united nations, a world in which the nations of the world would exist with one another in a free and peaceable, egalitarian kind of structure. In fact, as scores of nations began to realize, there continued to be economic domination, and there continued to be, as they began to see it, cultural domination. So that by the late 60s and early 70s, it was frequent that you would find not just Coca-Cola all over the world, but opposition to the fact that Coca-Cola was all over the world from countries who didn't have, and this was a famous metaphor of the time, they didn't even have running water so that kids could brush their teeth and get the sugar out of their mouths after drinking the Coca-Cola. There was concern about development priorities being massively distorted in favor of consumerism as a result of having a Western communications complex in their midst. And so there began to be a political movement to take shape to resist that and to try to bring not some kind of, you know, garishly weird set of political arrangements that might be anathema to what we take to be decency and, you know, normal kinds of human peaceability, but rather just a degree of what they used to call national sovereignty over their own cultural space. Mm-hmm. And 100 nations around the world, including many from Europe, concerned about this onslaught of commercialization, banded together into what began to be called a movement for a new international information order. Sometimes it was called the New World Information and Communications Order. What that meant in positive terms
was—
Now
we're talking 1970s.
So yes, 1970s. I'm sorry. And that was within the context of the then major organization for this area, the United Nations Educational, Cultural, Scientific and Cultural Organization.
UNESCO.
And this is not the only place, but it was one of the major places. And UNESCO had the effrontery, I guess you could say, to take somewhat seriously the principle of one nation, one vote, and so therefore there should be some openness to a discussion of these issues. And they convened a commission for the study of communication problems to do the first systematic canvas of international information flows and the flow of television programs and the flow of news, and it massively documented what everybody knew already was the case, which is that Hollywood movies had 85 25% of the screen time around the world, that the AP and a couple of other news agencies dominated the news accounts that were being read by people in Africa and Latin America and so forth. And they therefore resisted this to the extent of saying, let's have a full airing of what's going on and try to figure out how can we make it better? How can we nourish our own news agencies, our own film companies, our own television activities? And the U.S. said, sorry, we're not interested in this. And so eventually, under the new hardline approach favored by President Reagan, the United States withdrew from UNESCO.
It's a fairly dramatic gesture, since UNESCO is one of the part of the UN and one of the really main global institutions to promote peace.
Also ironic in a harmful way, because the UNESCO is one of the principal international organizations active in science and other areas of education and culture, where the U.S. itself benefits from international exchanges and from the kinds of scientific supports that go along with that.
What were the U.S. objections with the – seems like these are perfectly legitimate concerns. Countries become independent. They have very little control over their media systems, and most Americans wouldn't like it if our media system was controlled entirely by people who live 3,000 miles away and answer to shareholders who live 3,000 miles away. Why didn't the United States say, let's have this discussion. Let's figure out the best way to make this work for everyone's satisfaction.
Well, there's a number of factors there, not least the U.S. press had its own commercial interest very much tainted in the negotiations. The U.S. press wanted to be able to preserve its ability to set the international agenda, and its ability to do that was contingent on the U.S. dominance in UNESCO. And so they made up a story, basically, and it has to be said. They made up the story that UNESCO wanted to license journalists, and that by licensing journalists, that would be a terrible threat to a free press. UNESCO said no such thing. UNESCO never wanted to license journalists. And so this was a red herring that was created as a way of drumming up support for a hardline U.S. position in this organization, a position that was also endorsed not only by the press, by and large, but also by the executive branch agencies, which were concerned that UNESCO's so-called politicization and so-called mismanagement – these were both terms that were used to tar the organization – might result in some diminution of the freedom of U.S. military agencies and the freedom of U.S. big corporations to go anywhere they wanted around the world and sell whatever they wanted to anybody with maximum freedom.
Now, once the United States left UNESCO, and I think that's 1983 or 1984. 84. Does the UNESCO then say, okay, great, you guys are out of here. Now we're going to proceed full speed ahead and institute this new international information order?
Would that that were true, some of us may think. But no, UNESCO basically went through a terrible process of internal convulsion. UNESCO basically moved away from any militants that it once may have had. And it's important to say UNESCO was not some militant organization to begin with. It was a very moderate group in which all they were trying to do was to open up the discussion for some sort of international deliberation. Mm-hmm. So in the aftermath, the United States paid something like 25% of the bill for UNESCO, so their budget was cut severely. And in that move, and then Britain withdrew as well, because Britain and the United States, as we know from our own time, often act together on international affairs. Britain and the United States' withdrawal meant that UNESCO went through a process of what they call soul searching and ended up at the other end of it without any of the militants that once might have been there in some of the margins.
And does the United States – it did return to UNESCO, did it not? Just
the United States returned to UNESCO in, I think, 2003. 19-year absence.
19-year absence. So this was sort of this moment then that sort of came, burst across the sky in the 1970s and then sort of went away. But the issues didn't go away.
Well, the issues didn't go away, and some of the action changed to other agencies. Mm-hmm. UNESCO never entirely lost its interest in this, even when the U.S. wasn't a member. There was stuff happening on the sidelines. But in the meantime, there were bilateral treaties. The NAFTA treaty that the United States signed with Canada and Mexico has some language having to do with cultural exchanges, in which the Canadians insisted that there should be provision made for culture not as a commodity, but rather as an area of human identity that should be free of commercial considerations.
So culture should not be part of these various trade deals that are being negotiated all the time by the U.S. government.
It wasn't even as blanket an exemption as that, but just to say that nations had the right to reserve to make exceptions in the cultural field for areas that they deemed to be crucial to their own national identity and culture.
No, that's in NAFTA. Is that in these other is that an issue being negotiated in various World Trade Organization
Absolutely.
Negotiations?
Absolutely. It is also available as a result of the efforts of Canada and of France, who have been the two developed country leaders in this area. It is also available as a clause in the World Trade Organization mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been used. And so the question of what used to be called 10, 15 years ago, the cultural exception, mm-hmm. continued to exist in the policymaking concerns and negotiations of leaders from most of the rest of the world.
We talk about foreign policy a lot on Media Matters and how the press covers foreign policy issues. We hear the press has done a pretty lousy job of covering all these issues. Virtually no coverage whatsoever about global internet and media regulation and development. Within the United States government, is the Bush administration radically different from the Clinton administration, or is there really, on these sort of issues, a commonality of policy, would you say?
I would say that there is a bipartisan policy on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
The question of what sort of a presence to project in negotiations internationally on communications and information has been, by and large, a bipartisan project for 50 years. There are exceptions, and of course there are moments of disagreement within the government that can be aggravated when you have a shift from one party's administration to the other. Such a change occurred certainly in the movement from Carter to Reagan. But as I mentioned before, in the context of discussing the International Telecommunications Satellite Consortium and the Carter administration's view on that, there was, in fact, a lot of continuity, and there remains continuity in agreement to the elemental notion that U.S. culture industry interests, U.S. film companies, U.S. TV companies, U.S. internet companies, U.S. telecom companies must be given maximum freedom to go anywhere on earth they want to make money.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We'll be back 1 week from today with a live show. I think it'll be a live show, but we'll have lots of live shows coming up. This show recorded, so thank you for not calling in today. We've only got a few minutes left, Dan Schiller. People listening to this show want to start following these issues, want to get involved in it. They're not academics. They don't want to get an advanced degree. They don't want to take a seminar, but they understand we have an audience of people who understand the importance of who controlling the media and how it's controlled, influencing the quality of their lives and the world politics. Where would you recommend people tune into or go to stay on top of issues like the ones we've been talking about with the World Trade Organization, with the World Summit and the Information Society, with Internet Governance, with UNESCO?
On the web, you can go to WSIS.org.
WSIS.org.
I'm sure you can go to a variety of other sites in the United States, possibly freepress.org. Mm-hmm. will have some material on it. That would be desirable. .net, sorry.
That's all right.
If you can go to another site, it's always good to go outside the United States for some other kinds of viewpoints. You could try Le Monde Diplomatique as an English language version. It's a French monthly, and you could go to Le Monde Diplomatique, look it up on the web on a search engine. You'll find the site and see if you can get some coverage. They have been covering these issues very intelligently for a number of years.
And are there a book or two, and feel free to mention your own, if you wish, because they're great books, Dan Schiller, that you'd recommend people if they want to bone up on some background issues or get
Bob, you'll have to help me on the title, but the Shano Sukru book, is it World Communication Governance? What is it called?
Ooh, no, you're quizzing me. That's not how it works on this show, man. I'm the one who quizzes you. Global Media Governance?
Global Media Governance would be a good primer for knowing something about where all of these issues stand and what are the organizations to know about. I really can't think of a better single-volume treatment than that.
How about the history? Some of these issues we've been talking about with satellites, with radio, are there any places you'd suggest people go to?
Well, I think some of your own work on radio,
well,
I know you're very modest, but
domestic.
But you've been involved with the Canadian-U.S. discussions of this. On radio, if you want to learn a little bit about the early radio, you could go to Spreading the American Dream by Emily Rosenberg. Is a very accessible treatment of about 20 years ago, has a chapter on it. If you want to learn about the satellite issue, you could look at Mass Communications and American Empire by a relative of mine, Herbert I. Schiller.
Yeah, it's one of the classic works, if not the classic work, in the field of international communication in the United States. Dan Schiller, we've only got a few seconds left. Do you have anything you'd want to wrap up with before we conclude today?
Well, just keep attending to these issues because this is something that is not going to go away, and what you don't know can hurt you. So let's try to pay some attention. Thanks for making that possible here, Bob.
Yeah, well, we're going to stay on top of this issue here, and we're going to have you be a frequent guest, especially when your new book comes out next year. But the story breaks and as new developments take place, we will be back on top of internet governance at the global level here at Media Matters. Dan Schiller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob.
It's been a pleasure having you. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. And I'll be back 167 hours from right now. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, as always, for his terrific job as my producer. All right. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a chance of showers, breezy with a high in the upper 50s, and southeast winds 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms, breezy with a low in the lower 50s, and south winds around 15 to 25 miles per hour, becoming 20 to 25 miles per hour after midnight. This is WILL Urbana. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The number of new HIV cases in the U.S. is down slightly, but not among African Americans and Latinos. As we approach World AIDS Day, December 1, we'll talk about politics, prevention, and treatment around the globe.
In Kenya,